All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated.
Good morning, Mr. Kelly.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it please the court, my name is William G. Kelly, Jr., and I represent the appellants who are suppliers and bidders for contracts to supply durable medical equipment under the Medicare competitive bidding provisions. This case has really recently turned into what we call a case about secret standards. While the government in its brief has said that nothing is hidden, since the case was initially filed, bits and pieces of information have come to light, and on Monday morning, I hope the Your Honors have it, we filed a 28-J letter that consisted of a transcript of a agency-sponsored webcast that made very clear that the agency and its contractors are applying a scoring and a scoring threshold system that suppliers must meet before they can qualify to bid. Now, there's nothing about this in the regulations at all. Reading Section 414D of the regulations, which is the financial standards portion of the regulations, all it says is that suppliers are required to submit the financial covered documents that are specified in the request for bids.
How about that website of the the website of the competitive bidding implementation contractor. Are they not there?
That's what this is from.
Oh, okay. So the scoring is.
It's part of under the statute, the agency was specifically authorized to hire a contractor to help them with implementation, and they act as kind of agents of the.
Right, and is this scoring on their website?
Well, it actually the search. It's the you get to it through the CMS website, but it appears that the actual webcast was delivered by the contractor.
Okay, I'm just trying to find out what is secret about it. I mean, you can find it out, the scoring, right? Or
at this point, you can.
All right.
Though part of it is secret. I mean, they say they have a scoring methodology and there's a threshold, but they don't tell you how it works.
Okay. And they didn't tell you at the time that the reg was being considered. That's your argument, right?
Well, when the complaint was first filed, we actually thought they didn't have any standards at all.
Okay.
And then when it first came, I think when we got a first firm indication of it was when they filed rejection forms about 6 months after the filing of the complaint. The rejection forms had a column that talked about possible rejection for not meeting the financial standards, which were a calculated score from as shown on those rejection forms. But that was one of the things about that was for round one, and we're now into round two, which is a much, much larger portion of the competitive bidding program. It's about to go nationwide, and they're right now considering the financial documents and the rest of the bid package. So round two is now imminent, and what the transcript says that's in the 28J letter is they're definitely planning to use this scoring system and threshold system throughout round two. It would also presumably be used in the second rebid of round one, which is due to come up.
Would you like to talk about the question of jurisdiction?
Yes, I would like to talk about it. If I I would like to, if possible, with deference to Your Honor, finish talking about the standards part of it, because I believe it impacts the standard.
You can use your time any way you want, but I'd like you to address jurisdiction.
Right now, Your Honor?
Whenever you want.
Okay. Certainly will. The case has taken on kind of a Kafkaesque quality, in our view, because the agency has asserted that there are three different standards that they believe meet the requirements for them to specify financial standards that the suppliers must meet in order to bid. First, they say the documents and the ratios calculated from those documents are sufficient as standards. We don't think anybody can think of those as standards. The district court and later on in their briefs, the government has said that, well, overall financial soundness, which is mentioned in the preamble to the final rule, is the standard they're relying on. The problem with both of it, with that and what we now call the secret standards, the actual scoring standards that it appears they're going to apply, is they were never proposed for notice and comment. And the part about overall financial soundness is only in the preamble to the final rule. It's not in the final rule at all. No mention of it, whatever. So obviously these secret standards, the scoring standards, the thresholds are now the real standards. There's been no notice and comment. And the other two do not qualify as actual rules that would meet the
requirements. These are standards for the awarding of, these are standards that relate to the awarding of the contract, and we are precluded from considering challenges to the awarding of contracts.
Right, and I want to move on.
You agree
to
with that?
I want to move on to that.
Wait,
now.
Did you say right?
Pardon?
I'm sorry, you said right? Judge Kavanaugh said we're precluded from reviewing the awards of contracts, and you said you agree?
No, I said I want to move on to that issue.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
I'm sorry if you misheard me. So I believe on the issue of preclusion, looking at the standard of review, I think what we have here is what in DART was recognized as a real facial violation of a clear statutory requirement, and that's the requirement to specify financial standards taking into account the needs of small providers, and also the mandate to do it through notice and comment, which is both in the APA 553 and also in the rulemaking provisions of the Medicare Act, which are 1395HH. And in DART, what the court said was, even if the language appears plain, we're going to look at it the preclusion language appears plain, we're going to look at it very closely, and if there's the slightest ambiguity, we're going to rule against preclusion. Also pertinent to standard of review are the Supreme Court's opinion in McNary and Lindahl, in which the court noted that Congress is very familiar with the issues of preclusion that arise under Medicare, and it knows how to use broad language when it wants to write a broad preclusion. And what we have in this case is a preclusion provision that has a list of seven very specific, down to the subsection noted categories of preclusion. The two on which the government relies, the agency relies, are the awarding of contracts and the bidding structure. On the awarding of contracts, first of all, that language is plainly susceptible to a reading that it concerns individual determinations on contracts. In other words, a contract is a transaction between individual parties. And awarding of contracts can clearly be read as them wanting to stay away from decisions on individual factual situations involving the awarding of contracts to a specific entity.
Usually when you challenge a contract award, you're going to challenge why the contract was awarded, which means you're going to challenge the reasons for the contract award, the criteria by which the contract award was decision was made. Doesn't that all go together and therefore envelop what your challenge is here?
They are in it. They're intertwined. I mean, everything in the durable equipment statute is intertwined in some way. But there's a big difference that's been recognized between individual determinations on contracts or reimbursement and broad issues with regard to what are called collateral issues or systemic issues. And the court has upheld that distinction. I think the most recent one is Jackson versus General Electric, where it says it recognizes the distinction in McNary between individual determinations and methodology that was first raised in Bowen versus Michigan Academy of Physicians. But we don't need to just talk about awarding of contracts because we have some legislative history on that language, and that was in the conference report on the original legislation in 2003. And the conference report said with regard to the companion provision on competitive bidding for drugs and biologicals, which they separated from the equipment provision, that awarding of contracts meant contract awards. And I don't think anything could be clearer than that. But regardless of how clear you might think it is, there's definitely a plausible reading that refers to individual contract determinations. We have also we've also brought up as an allegation in the original complaint and in the motions to amend the complaint that when those were filed, there was no awarding of contracts. I see I'm going into my rebuttal time, which I've asked to reserve.
One quick question: if we were to agree with you, what would be the remedy?
The remedy would be to vacate the rulemaking and remand to the agency.
But what about all the contracts?
Pardon?
What about all the contracts that have been awarded?
We've thought hard about that, and that is. There are contracts that have been awarded under round one, and that poses a difficult question. Round two is an easy question, and the rebid on round one, the second rebid on round one is an easy question. I don't think we can vacate the contracts that have already been awarded on round one. What does make sense is to allow those who have met all the other requirements for contracts under round one to seek reimbursement at the fee schedule price that was in effect before the rulemaking. In other words, restore the status quo ante. Can I have another minute to address bidding structure? Preclusion.
Yes, go ahead. Now, if you use the time now, that's all the time, but we'll give you a couple minutes. But if you want to use your full time now, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, we think bidding structure is plain. The preclusion on that is plain, that it relates just to bidding. There's nothing in the list of preclusion that says anything about financial standards, quality standards, or some of the other provisions of the statute, such as the need to rebid every 3 years. Also, the regs are very clear in making a separation between bidding and financial standards. For example, the definition of a bid is that it's a price offer, which financial standards are not. The definition of the covered financial documents says expressly that it does not include the bid. Section 414D, which supposedly contains the financial standards, says that the documents that are required are to be submitted along with the bid. And then the 28J letter we filed has a very, in sections 10 to 13, has a very neat explanation of what the bidding structure is. So again, there's a very plain and plausible reading of what bidding structure means. And given the strong presumption in favor of judicial review, I don't think that there's anything clear and convincing that indicates, and considering DART also, that indicates that Congress intended this type of case to be precluded. So what we have is an outright dodge of notice and comment here, and no clear and convincing evidence of preclusion. And the relief we're requesting is to have the rulemaking vacated, send the agency back to do notice and comment rulemaking on the financial standards, particularly the types of ones that they're using now. And I think we'll have to leave it to the court's discretion to how to handle the round one contracts. I've made a suggestion, but I'm not sure that's the only one that can be made.
All right, thank you. Ms. Swingle?
Thank you, Your Honor. Sharon Swingle from the Department of Justice, representing the Secretary for the Department of Health and Human Services and the Administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I'd like to begin, as my opposing counsel left off, with the preclusion provision. Obviously, the district court relied on that provision to find that there was no jurisdiction. I think the preclusion provision is clear that the bidding structure of the competitive bidding program is something that is immune from administrative judicial review. And the normal understanding of bidding structure includes the required components under the statute of the competitive bidding program. I think that reading is highlighted by the remainder of that provision, which also bars review of the number of contractors selected. The number of contractors selected itself depends in part on the Secretary's evaluation of the financial capacity of those suppliers, of the extent to which they can serve not only their existing market, but potentially a greater market. So that is integrally tied in with an evaluation of the financial documentation and financial ratios of bidders under the program. Obviously, the preclusion provision also bars review of the awarding of contracts. And under Illinois counsel, I think the Supreme Court has been clear that you can't evade a restriction on the review of individual contract awards by purporting to challenge some component by which that award would be determined. So I think both of those provisions would come to play here. I think the remaining provisions of the preclusion provision are clear that Congress really intended to bar essentially all pre-implementation review of the program, which is not surprising given the billions of dollars that were anticipated to be saved on an annual basis through competitive bidding.
Suppose the Secretary issued these standards without notice and comment.
I want to be clear, we do not take the position that there could not be review.
I thought you said that the Congress wanted to preclude all pre-implementation judicial review.
Of wholly ultra-virus agency action. I don't think that question is before the court.
I know that. I know it's not. That's why I started the question with a suppose.
And let me be, I apologize, Judge Tatel. Yeah. We haven't taken a position on whether the preclusion provision would bar even review of, for example, an ultra-virus complaint that the Supreme Court recognized in Leadham v. Kine might be an exception, or, for example, a constitutional claim. I think our position on that is they simply haven't made out that kind of claim. There obviously was notice and comment rulemaking here. I appreciate that they challenged the adequacy of that rulemaking, but it did occur. There was a promulgation of financial standards. Again, they challenged the adequacy of those financial standards, but it did take place, and they have not raised a constitutional claim before the court. So I think this is really a run-of-the-mill APA challenge of the sort that would normally be understood to fall within the preclusion provision. And I think the other provisions of that B11 do make fairly clear that it would make very little sense to bar review of the implementation of the competitive bidding program, which is one of the subsection of the awarding of contracts, of the establishment of payment amounts, of the selection of the geographic areas in which competitive bidding would be rolled out, of the selection of the items and services that would be subjected to competitive bidding, and yet nevertheless to have allowed review of financial standards. Similarly, while quality standards are not singled out, the district court found that all of the required components, both quality standards and the financial standards, were encompassed within the bidding structure provision. It's clear that Congress did not intend for any delay in implementing the quality standards to allow for delay in implementation of the program, and yet under the plaintiff's theory here, there would presumably be judicial review of the adequacy of the quality standards as well, which is very difficult to square with Congress's intent. And then obviously we can look and see what Congress itself did when it briefly delayed implementation of round one and required rebidding after problems had arisen in the initial bidding program. Although it did provide for a limited delay of that implementation, it did so only in tandem with a fairly significant budget-neutral offset to try and make up for some of the loss in savings due to implementation of the program. So it's hard to imagine, in the face of that significant concern for budget savings, that Congress would have intended for there to be judicial review that could have delayed the program. If I may turn to standing, the district court found in the alternative that the plaintiffs here lacked standing, and obviously we've raised that as an alternate ground for the court's affirmance. I think the main problem with each of the plaintiffs' theory of standing is that the claimed injury relates either to a threatened or actual loss of a contract or to the award of a contract at a lower bidding price. And yet there are absolutely no allegations in this record that would support a plausible inference that any of these bidders actually were denied a bid because of their failure to meet financial standards, or that they were awarded a bid but that the financial standards established by the Secretary somehow impacted that bid. I would point out that the initial complaint was filed after the first round of bidding.
They don't need to show that for Article III standing, do they?
Well, I think they do need to show some injury in fact, Judge Kavanaugh.
Sure, but challenging a directly regulated party by an illegal, allegedly illegal process, that would be garden variety Article III standing.
Well, I think the question is what it means to be a directly regulated party. This regulation, the challenged regulation, is somewhat unusual in the sense that it doesn't itself allocate burdens or benefits, impose liabilities. It establishes a bidding framework, and if that bidding framework never had any impact on the plaintiffs, it's difficult to understand how they would show injury. If they were disqualified, as appears to be the case, because they didn't submit the necessary documents, then it's impossible to find, based on those allegations or based on that record, that the lack of clarity of the financial standards that they complain about had any impact on them. They were never evaluated for their ability to meet the substantive financial criteria.
Maybe, but I would think a would-be contractor that's challenging allegedly illegal contract process would have Article III standing as a general matter. Maybe I'm missing. You're saying you have to jump through a few more hoops and show you actually would have gotten the contract?
Well, I don't think you have to show you actually would have gotten the contract, but I do think you need to show a sufficient factual basis for the court to be able to infer that there was a concrete particularized injury that you either suffered or would have suffered. And here, where the only either allegations in the record or records that the plaintiffs have put forward suggest that they were never evaluated for their ability to meet the financial standards because they failed at earlier stages of the process or potentially didn't even bid. It's difficult. I think it would be wholly speculative for the court to find that they were actually injured as they claim. We agree that directly regulated parties have standing. We're not disputing that the court can assume in the face of their challenge that there would have been a change to the financial standards. The question is whether the court can make kind of the subsequent causal connection to show that that change in financial standards would have had any impact on them. And that's the burden we think that they haven't satisfied here. And then finally, turning to the merits, obviously, were the court to agree with the government that they lack jurisdiction here, there's no need for the court to reach the merits. But we do think that the Secretary's actions and its rulemaking here fully comply with the requirements of the statute and accord with the policies and goals that Congress sought to effectuate in the competitive bidding program. I think the main argument that the plaintiffs make a couple of arguments. One of their arguments is that they simply didn't know what the government was going to be doing here, that the proposed rulemaking and the final rules didn't adequately explain to them what they would be required to show to establish their financial soundness. And I think on the face of the rulemaking, that is just not a viable theory. The proposed rule explained the various financial ratios and standards that the Secretary would be looking at, set forth with some detail what the proposed documentation was going to be that potential bidders would need to supply to show that they had the financial capacity to provide the equipment under the terms of their contract. The final rule took the same approach. The preamble explicitly set out in great detail the documents that would be required in the round one competitive bidding to establish that bidders had the requisite financial stability. And the Secretary also told potential bidders exactly which financial ratios would be calculated based on those documents, so as to determine whether bidders would have financial capacity to serve the market, to determine what portion of the potential market would be allocated to them for purposes of determining how many bidders to select and so forth. So I think the rulemaking really does satisfy the requirements of the statute. And I think this court's precedents are clear that unless Congress has specifically mandated a level of detail in the statute for the establishment, for example, of standards or criteria, that the government has broad discretion to pick the level of generality. And here, while the Secretary has set out quite clearly specific documents that will be required and what those documents will be used for, she's also chosen to leave herself the flexibility in the context of this large new bidding program to be able to modify either the documentation requirements or the ratios as experience bears out that more or less might be required.
I don't want to outthink myself here, but if the plaintiffs, if they do have Article III standing, then your two arguments are one, preclusion, and two, the merits. My understanding is that we could, even though it's termed a question of jurisdiction under Steel Co., we could do either one because it's a question of statutory jurisdiction. Is that your understanding as well?
I think that's right, Your Honor. And obviously we would welcome the court's resolution on either ground. If the court has no further questions.
I do have a question about, I just want to get a picture of the small providers. It seems like this equipment, iron lungs and hospital beds and so forth, are the small providers specialty shops or manufacturers, or do you know?
I don't know, Your Honor. My understanding is that some of the suppliers are distributors, not direct manufacturers, and some may be manufacturers. It was an industry with a large percentage of small suppliers participating.
Okay. Is there a definition of small providers?
It's my understanding is it's gross revenues from both Medicare and non-Medicare customers of $3.5 million a year or less.
Okay.
And of course, there are unique provisions within the rulemaking to protect the interests of those small suppliers. Even the financial documentation was reduced to reduce the burden to small suppliers, among others. And then there are provisions for allocating a specific percentage of the bidding contract awards to small suppliers. Thank you.
Thank you. Does Mr. Kelly have any time? Yep. All right, why don't you take 2 minutes, Mr. Kelly?
2 minutes.
Yes, this is about 85%, they estimate, is our small providers. Most of them are distributors. And I think it's important to note that there is absolutely, even though the statute says that in setting standards, they're supposed to take into account the needs of small providers, there's nothing to indicate that they did that. They did it with regard to the burdens of documentation, but nothing with regard to the standards. with regard to preclusion, according to the bidding structure, the counsel for the agency pointed out that financial information is considered in considering capacity and the number of contractors that can service a particular CBA. That is true, but that has nothing to do with the part about actually qualifying to bid. Yes, they use the financial information to within the bidding structure, but it's not part of the standards to get into the bidding part of the game. They also cited Illinois Council, which is completely, it has to do with a line of cases that did allow judicial review. But there were what are called channely cases. They just required that any collateral issue, such as we have here, be first channeled through the administrative process before going to court. And that's not what we have here. The statute just completely, if it applies, would completely foreclose judicial review, which is something that the Supreme Court has noted numerous times and this court has noted numerous times. It was very reluctant to do with regard to a possible violation of a statutory mandate. Counsel for the agency insists that this was covered in the NPRM. I mean, you can search the one column in the NPRM on financial standards and find nothing about scoring or thresholds or indeed about anything other than documentation and the use of company-specific financial ratios. It does say they're developing a methodology, but doesn't say what it is, and it doesn't appear to even ask for comments on what that might be. We have really no notice and comment in this case at all. And that's reflected elsewhere in the record with numerous protests from the bidders about, you know, when are you going to publish the financial standards? We even had a question from a PAOC member on when are you going to publish the standards. The government said, we're not. We think that would disturb the integrity of the process, whatever that meant. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you.
Does the court have any more questions?
No.